Hi there, I'm Celeste Headley. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. It's a podcast that turns up the volume with new ideas about how women succeed. We want to help you stay informed about the best practices in work and at home. And so we bring you conversations with brilliant women. Women who have innovative and proven strategies that'll help you advance in your career and still stay balanced in your personal life. Today we talk with Cy Wakeman. For 25 years, Cy has been helping organizations ditch drama and make workplaces calmer, more focused, and more successful. She works with more than 200 companies every year and was named one of the top 100 leadership experts to follow on Twitter. Here's our conversation.
Let's start first with some definitions, if that's okay. So, for example, you're all about no drama, but I wondered if you would define drama for us. What behavior counts as drama?
Drama, in the broader sense, is unproductive thinking and disruptive behavior. We call it emotional waste. It is anything taking energy away from It's anything taking energy away from results and happiness in the workplace. It's a subtraction.
You don't mean to say there should be no emotion, strong emotion in the workplace.
Right. It's not about emotion. So when someone says, I'm passionate, we want emotion, but passion shouldn't hurt. And when your passion becomes harmful to the process is the point where emotion crossed over into drama. And I would also tell you that a lot of the emotion we have in the workplace is not visceral or sincere emotion. A lot of the emotion we have is emotion that comes from the story we tell ourselves about our reality, not necessarily reality. So a lot of the negative emotion, anger, stress, disappointment, is actually not true emotion. It's a response to a story where we're not using good mental processes and we're upset about lots of things that maybe even didn't happen.
So walk me through this. I am working on a project. I have been assigned three teammates. Two of them have done their jobs beautifully. One of them has completely fallen down on the job, not met their deadlines. And so I was up all night finishing the project. I feel angry. At what point does that feeling of anger crossover into emotional waste?
So if you got self-reflective, the average person is going to sit that morning and go, I am the victim and this is ridiculous and everybody let me down and I'm the only one who does anything around here and I'm surrounded by idiots and I'm surrounded by jerks. And if you check your story and you go, what do I know for sure? I know I didn't manage that project well. I know I waited to the last minute to get what I need. I know that I don't know why I didn't get the information I need. But if I move all past judging, then I don't have a lot to be angry about. I happened to work late last night on a project that I didn't prepare well for. And so if I am not at peace with that, I could do a lot of things differently. Like even if I'm up all night with a project, I can be up all night peacefully with that project.
So how does a worker then deal with actual problems with management and processes that may actually be causing problems in the workplace? How do you do that if you're holding yourself accountable? How does that end up having changes in, say, structure or work process?
So short term, I look for my part in that and I clean up my piece so that long term, I can go into this from a neutral perspective, which uses good business discipline and problem solving process. So on the if I go into this as I'm the victim, everybody lets me down, I'm the only one working hard here, then my solutions tend to be overreactive and ego-based. So it's short-term, long-term. In the short-term, I realize that I end up working longer and later on a project than I prefer. And my piece in that is that I'm not using good project management methodology. And longer-term, I go to people neutrally, and instead of judging them for letting me down, I ask them for what I need And I'm even willing to put reminders on their calendar to get what I need to better manage a project differently in the future. So it's the difference between getting what you want through venting, complaining, and judging, and getting what would benefit the organization through problem solving, studying the trends, studying the data, making sure that we have a mind towards what would benefit our customers. And so many people come into it from an ego perspective of here's my preference, and they want their preference to trump potential. But the reality is here's what the customers could benefit from. And it's more of a higher level of consciousness, a high-minded approach to problem solving.
So you just used the word venting, and that's another one of the things I want to define, because in many of your talks and in your book, you draw a clear line between expressing feelings and venting. What is the difference?
Sure. Venting is actually a behavior, and expressing feelings has to do with what you're experiencing in the moment. And expressing feelings usually takes about one sentence. I'm frustrated with Alex, and I might add he didn't get me the information I needed for this report. Venting is all the stuff I make up about that. He does this crap on purpose, and he's out to get me, and he's trying to throw me under the bus, and he's always done this, he'll never change. And all that color commentary I add to that is the venting part. And if we use inquiry and we really say, what do I know for sure? Anything we're venting on falls away. And all we're left with is we don't yet have the information we need. If I'm venting and I need to come up with a solution, I have to change Alex. If I'm sharing a feeling and I have to come up with a solution, I then just change me. And the Dalai Lama talks about if you're suffering, you have two options. You can accept it and let it go. It just is what it is. Be happy anyway. If it's fixable, fix it. And most of us want this third option. I don't want to take action to impact it. My ego is telling me I shouldn't have to. And I don't want to let it go. I want to stay in this very miserable place where I just complain about it. I just vent on it. And too many of our open doors have become portals for drama, where people come in and they scorekeep and tattle and talk about people not present. And they basically just share their own suffering. But most people don't realize that so much of their suffering is optional, definitely, and self-imposed most of the time.
So you've done research that shows the average employee spends 2.5 hours a day enmeshed in drama. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Even really good employees spend 2.5 hours a day in a fierce argument with reality, which is, you know, it's an argument they're going to lose, but only like 100% of the time. And most of my work is teaching people how their mind works so they quit believing all they're thinking. They can question it, and learning how the world works so they quit arguing with it. Most people's frustration are because their data and their thinking is corrupted, or they are wishing the world worked differently.
Well, then I want to go into this, what is reality? I don't want to get all metaphysical on us, but you tell a story about when you were heading up HR and you kept having to move offices.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping you'll tell that story again, because my question at the end of the story was, how did you know that was reality and not changeable? So first, could you tell us how you ended up moving, I think, five times
in 18 months. So I was leading an HR team, and we had some exciting things going on in our campus where I worked. We had a lot of new buildings being built, and we were excited because ultimately we would get brand new offices. But the path to get those new offices involved planned three different moves. And so we moved the first time to a very old building. Long story short, we got headaches. Everyone on my team started to get headaches. And then what we did was we called employee health, and they came and they thought it was something environmental. So they took our blood, and we were basically given a pamphlet on lead poisoning and moved out of that office. And then I got temporary offices where we could see our new building being built. And it was like looking like hope through the window. And then the company found out that building was being built on Native American burial grounds, and we watched that building being torn down. So my team is faced with all this moving, and now our final option isn't even an option. Long story short, we were asked to move for the fifth time in 18 months, and my team lost it. They're like, what about our engagement? And this is absolutely unacceptable. And, you know, we don't have the tools to do our work. And if we had best friends at work, they couldn't find us. And they were just done moving. And I asked them how I could help as their leader. And they basically said, go march on the CEO's office and stop the moving. Change our reality. We want no more moving. Now, the organization required moving. That's how we knew it was our reality, because it's what was being required of us. But I went off to the CEO's office and I was ready to demand that my team not be moved. And thank God a mentor intervened. And she came by and she said, Sai, what's up? And I said, my people are suffering. And she said, why are they suffering? And I said, because they move all the time. And she said, well, that's the reality. We've asked them to move five times. Why are they suffering? And she was the first leader to separate out suffering from reality. The reality was we were asked to move five times. Now, our suffering was because we hadn't yet gotten mobile. If we were mobile, moving wouldn't hurt. See, we could grow our skill set so that we were immune to the effects of being moved. And we could just wander freely in the world and happily in the world. But instead of getting skilled up on being mobile, we resisted and complained. And we made up rules like we shouldn't have to move. And then when everybody when we made up these rules and we had to move, people were mad about the rules we made up being broken. But we're the ones that made the rules up. The reality was, at least presented to us, that we needed to move. And it's not about getting passive, but it's about moving beyond your own opinion. A leader's true role is not managing people, it's managing the energy of people. And my job was to go back to my people and, instead of listening to why we shouldn't have to and how we can't, to say, if our goal is to be mobile so moving doesn't hurt, how can we get mobile and fuel innovation? But most teams get bogged down in the drama of venting about why we shouldn't have to. And our natural state is innovation, but only when the drama's gone. And most leaders don't understand their role of managing energy away from why we can't to how we could. And so in that case, how do I know what our reality was? Is that instead of moving patients on ventilators, the organization asked HR to move, and they weren't asking us to do anything illegal or unethical. They were just asking us to do something beyond our preference, and preference comes from ego. And so this isn't about being passive and just letting other people determine your future, but it's about, within your reality, succeeding anyway, because our reality, our circumstances aren't the reasons we can't succeed. Most of the time, it's just the reality in which we must succeed. And that's where people step down rather than step up way too often.
So you also have mentioned that the amount of drama in workplaces has gone up. And I wonder if you have theories on why that is.
I think that the amount of drama has gone up because the traditional leadership philosophy we teach fuels the drama through enabling. And there's a huge focus out right now on how to fix reality and make perfect workplaces so that people can feel comfortable and safe. And it's an undoable task. If you go back to the research about happiness, only 10% comes from your circumstances. 40% comes from the amount of accountability you take for your circumstances. Yet when employees are unhappy, they come to leaders to change circumstances. And even if I changed the entire world, that would only get you 10% more happy. Or I could help you grow in accountability, and that would get you 40% happier. And it's portable. You'll be less dependent upon your circumstances, so you can wander more freely in the world. But most leaders aren't working on themselves and others, growing in knowledge how their mind works and knowledge how the world works and self-actualization. They are listening to venting and then going to try and change people's reality. And many times it's a wild goose chase.
So how do you mesh that with that research, with the other research that shows that oftentimes for people to feel satisfied, say with a conversation or with a meeting, they just need to be heard. How does that mesh with the caution against venting?
So feeling heard and feeling colluded with are two different things. So if I'm a leader, there's a difference between sympathy and empathy. If you come to me and I sympathize with you, I see you're suffering, but I go on to feel sorry for you and collude with you and reinforce your victim mindset and come to agree with you that the problem, the enemy, is our circumstances or other people, places, and things. And venting does feel good. It's short term, but so do other unhealthy behaviors. You know, drinking too much, eating a whole sheet cake initially feels good, but long term, it doesn't promote well-being. Empathy is, I still hear you and I see that you're suffering, but instead of going on to collude with you and agree with you and feel sorry for you, I instead call you up to greatness to help you move to a different part of your intelligence so that you can find places to have impact in the world rather than see yourself as a victim of the world. So if venting and feeling heard worked, then people would only need to vent once, feel heard, move on. But that's not the nature of venting.
So how do, if you're trying to encourage people to see the greatness in themselves, and one of the questions you tell people to ask is, what would great, if you're going to be great, what would that look like, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet people are not very accurate in judging themselves. Every time we research this, they're quite accurate in seeing where other people's failings are and not very good at seeing their either their own deficiencies or their own areas of expertise, where they are an expert, where they are not. How do you, boost that ability to judge oneself?
We're not asking one to evaluate or rate oneself. That's not the self-assessment we're looking for. We're looking for self-reflection. And that's very different. People's self-assessment without practice isn't very accurate. But everyone knows the answer to what great looks like. The problem is they're allowed to use it to judge other people on rather than measure themselves up to. Like, I know what great looks like. It's what you're not doing. It's how other people aren't driving. It's what HR isn't doing. But many of us have the knowledge what great would look like if we were great right now. And if, as a leader, I help people to apply that question to themselves, they can fill in the gap. I'm not asking how great do you think you are right now. I'm asking if you were great right now, if you were operating at your peak performance, what would that look like? And asking yourself to step up to that. So it isn't a reliance on self-assessment. It's a call to greatness where we would start to hold ourselves to the standards we judge other people on.
It's so interesting. You know, there's a few things that you talk about that are quite counterintuitive to current practice. So I just wanted to walk through three of them, if that's okay. The first one is this idea about bringing your whole self to work. You say no.
No, do not do that. When people say, I want to bring my whole self to work, I'm like, do not do that. I want you to bring your most evolved self to work. Now, that includes all of your diversity. It just includes you working your own program, you self-regulating, you moving into accountability. Bring your best self to work and your most evolved self home. But what people don't necessarily understand how their mind works is like you have a toggle switch on your forehead that's like a light switch. And when it's toggled down, you're into what I call ego, into low self. You're seeing the world through a corrupted viewpoint. You see yourself as the victim and other people as you know, the villain. And you blame your suffering on your circumstances. And you tend to disengage and you feel better by tattling and venting and, you know, scorekeeping. When you're toggled up, you're seeing the world from a whole different perspective. Toggled down is like your most limited primitive intelligence. Toggled up is brain coherence. You're innovative. You're seeing all kinds of options where you can plug and play. Same person, toggled down or up. I want you to come to work toggled up. And that requires you to maintain a program of self-evolution, to maintain the ability to know how your mind works, unhook from ego, see things more clearly. And you do that. How do you get from low self to high self? Is self-reflection, not self-assessment. That research on self-assessment that says we're inaccurate at self-assessment is usually because we're toggled down in ego and our view of the world's distorted. I'm talking about toggling up, and self-reflection is what toggles us up so that you're using a greater part of your intelligence in order to move through the world more skillfully, more happily, and by the way, more effortlessly.
So how efficient are you at making all of this stuff work, even in your home with kids?
Yeah, I have tons of kids. You know, the ego keeps us under its spell. And the way you loosen the ego's grip on your world is through self-reflection and self-inquiry. And it's a daily thing, but it really helps. Like when people come in and they're like, my teacher stinks. It's like, instead of venting to me about your teacher, I would rather, as your parent, just say, you know, instead of why does my teacher hate me? It's like, well, let's ask a better question. And the question is, what can I do to form a better relationship with my teacher? One, you're the victim and nobody feels great being the victim long term. The other one, you're tapping into a bunch of ideas that you can start to have impact on the world with, and you can practice skills and you can lean in. When people are toggled down in low self, they lean out, they disengage, and they blame the world. If you want to stay in the game, if you want to have impact, which is our natural craving in the world, you got to toggle up and change your questions and really try and find ways that I can move through the world differently.
So here's another counterintuitive thing you say. You don't keep an open door policy.
I do not.
And you, why is that?
So when I first became a leader, people are like, well, keep your door open. And I had come into leadership after being a counselor. And I'm like, well, that sounds like boundaryless. Like you're letting people who have a feeling or a story commission resources, and you're kind of at their mercy. And I tried it. I did research on it. The average, hey, do you have a minute, open door meeting lasted 45 minutes in length. The conversation usually was speculation, hearsay, venting, people not present, judgment, tattling. And the typical conclusion was, please don't do anything. I just wanted you to know. And it became a portal for drama. Not one person came through my door and said, I just left a meeting. I don't think I handled myself well. I think I'm unfit for human consumption. I need help. Said no one ever. They came to form a drama triangle to partner with me against another. And so for me, if somebody comes to your open door, they're probably bringing you very unprocessed work. And you as the leader start to process it. And he who processes it takes action. And you reinforce their victim mindset that this was too complex for them and they need to escalate this so that you can either collude with them and or fix it. So it's not that I don't want my door open. It's that I believe in shared accountability. So if you ask me, if I have a minute, I will ask you to share an accountability of processing what you're about to bring to me. And that's why I teach tools. And one of the tools I teach is called an SBAR, S-B-A-R. Sai, do you have a minute? Yes, you have an SBAR. And what an SBAR is a template that you walk yourself through so that you have reflected and you have edited your story down to the true essence of what the issue is. So the S in the acronym is, what's the current situation? And you may come to me and it's full of drama. You're like, I got three projects dumped on me. I, as your leader, neutralize it with you. I say, you have three new projects, continue, right? So that I help you use a better mental process. The B is relevant backgrounds. We don't work for the History Channel. You come in and you're like, well, it all started in 1983 when we went through the first merger. And I go, time out. Relevant background, how does this apply to where we're going in the future? Analysis is the A. What's your critical thinking? Have you fact-checked? Is this fake news? And then what are your recommendations, plural? Because if you have just one recommendation, it's usually that you're in this indignant righteousness where we must only do one thing, and I want you to have mental flexibility. And just by nature, that you have to do that level of self-reflection. Our time together is sacred. It's elevated. We're dealing with good factual information, and we're problem solving and using good business discipline to move forward. We're not using 45 minutes to vent. And so it's just insisting that people have good hygiene around their thinking. So if drama is emotional waste, we know in business the way you get rid of waste is a good process. And so the way you get rid of emotional waste is through a good mental process. And most people who are venting are not using a good mental process in that moment.
I would imagine that some of these things that you're saying is not what people want to hear. And I wonder how this goes over when you go in to work with maybe a culture that's more toxic than healthy.
You know what happens is we can't group everybody together, because in every culture, there is a group of people who are naturally in a state of high accountability, and they are thrilled because the same behavior can't please a high accountable and a low accountable at the same time. And right now, so many of our cultures are being held hostage by people in low states of accountability that there usually is the silent majority that feels excited about the possibility of having a workplace beyond ego. And how do I know this? Is if you say to somebody, you're going to be working on a team and they vent a lot and they talk behind each other's back and they gossip a lot and they're pretty miserable. Are you excited? Most of them aren't excited. So there's a whole part of a company, usually the majority of the company, that feels liberated, while I do tend to tick off some people who have a vested interest in staying the victim.
So before we close here, and I don't want to take you over time, but I wondered, what question do you still have? Like, what are you researching right now? What question is it that you're trying to get answered?
Oh, the one I'm working on right now, because we all have these anonymous surveys we're giving everybody, and I've started to see people be sophisticated. They vent in the form of a survey. And I believe that anonymity is hurting accountability, that under the guise of anonymity, I act in a way and say things in a way that I never would do publicly. And so we, in our effort to over-rotate on engagement, I have found that engagement without accountability creates entitlement. And I'm looking at ways in which in the organization we need to protect confidentiality, but we need to be careful of anonymity in the ways that it can really hurt accountability. So that's what I'm thinking about, how we could do some things differently and more transparently in our workplaces.
I would imagine there's also some social media platforms that would be interested in finding out.
You know, it's interesting, right? I can fire you and I can't go on Glassdoor and talk about the fact that you embezzled from the company, but you can go on Glassdoor and anonymously talk about how bad my company is for firing you for embezzlement, except you forget to mention the embezzlement part. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, absolutely. I'm on Twitter.
So we've over-rotated on wanting people to feel safe, but I believe that, like, your psychological safety, there's ways you can make that portable. It's not my responsibility completely to make sure you're safe. It's my responsibility to do no harm, but it's your responsibility to grow the skill set that you can have one-on-one conversations so you don't have to vent on social media.
Oh, that's really fascinating. I guess we'll be looking forward to that book, huh?
Yes, that's my next book.
Cy Wakeman, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And I know to some listeners, this sounds kind of harsh, but I would couch it and do all things with big love. And that way it's not as harsh as it may seem.
And could save them some time, right?
Exactly.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Les.
Cy Wakeman is a leadership expert featured on The Today Show, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and many others. She has three books. The latest is called No Ego: How Leaders Can Cut the Cost of Workplace Drama, End Entitlement, and Drive Big Results. If you you enjoyed this conversation, I really hope you'll like, subscribe, and maybe even write a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts. That helps other people find us. And you might consider sharing it with someone else who could use some of this great advice. Be sure to check out more offerings from one of our conferences for women near you. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation, drawing more than 45,000 women and men to its annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and Silicon Valley. For now, I'm Celeste Headley. This is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.